Welcome to Alaska Edition, a weekly public affairs program produced by Alaska Public Telecommunications Incorporated in the studios of KAKM. The host and moderator for Alaska Edition is Michael Carey.
Thank you for joining us. Our guests are Paul Jenkins of the Anchorage Daily Planet, Brendan Joel Kelly Helenthal of the Anchorage Press, and Andrea Gusty of the KTVA Channel 11. Thank you for joining us, Andrea. Paul, a federal judge has put the lawsuit against the Kinnick Arm project on the back burner on hold. There may be a settlement. Tell us more.
The city of Anchorage had sued the Federal Highway Administration or federal transportation officials to try to get them to withdraw their green light for the bridge across Kinnick Arm. Which may or may not ever be built. Our end of it, the Anchorage end of it, it turns out, looked like it was going to crowd the port, at least a portion of the port, and why nobody saw this before, of course, you know, who knows. But anyway, they decided at that point, we've got to fix this, we've got to reroute this. The federal judge, everybody wants this thing fixed. The city wants it fixed. I think the feds want it fixed. The judge said, you guys are close. They've got a lot of legal issues you have to still hammer out, but they're looking at design issues now. They got 45 days. And the judges view it to save time and money to let them do it this way.
And this would be a kind of classic of a lawsuit that ends in a settlement rather than all the things that are required for court.
This kind of thing, especially in federal court, where they just don't like to tie the courts up for months at a crack. This is a pretty usual step.
Okay, Brendan, the Anchorage Press carried a big story on the Pebble Mine, which, like the Kinnick Arm Crossing, may or may not eventuate. What did the press discover when you went out there, and what can you tell us?
Well, Mike Dingman, my reporter that went out there, basically in the article sums everything up from start to finish. It gives you an overview because, you know, we hear the commercials all the time. We've got the Pebble Girl, all this. But not everybody really knows the details and the history behind Pebble. It was discovered in 1988 by Cominco, which is now owned by Teck, which operates Red Dog Mine in conjunction with Nanocorp. They discovered copper then. Copper was really low priced at the time, so it wasn't a really big deal. They sort of went to the back burner. And then in the 2000s and 2001, a company called Northern Dynasty acquired the lease. And then in 2007, they partnered with Anglo-American and formed the Pebble Project and enter controversy. At that point, they figured out there's about 107 million ounces of gold in there. Gold is, you know, $1,000+ an ounce right now. And so that basically where they're at right now is in the exploratory process. But everybody knows that this is a controversial project because we're bombarded in the media commercials constantly.
If I may, isn't that really unusual? I mean, it's not like here in Anchorage we're going to be voting on something soon. But if you turn on your radio, FM, AM, you're going to hear these advertisements on both sides.
Exactly. And that's the point of the article that that Mike Dingman wrote, is this is the most premature fight over something that we won't see. 15, 20 years from now, ordinarily, the sort of argument that's going on right now would be happening for a project like this because it's so early in the process. They're not in the permitting process. There's at least 67 state, federal, and local permits they'll need to get that they're not even close to applying for at this stage. So the article is pretty much, this is where we actually are. And these are some of the reasons that there is this premature fight. One of them, of course, being the say he's referred to as the richest man in Alaska, although that's not necessarily true. There's some argument about it. But Bob Gillum, who owns his own lodge on Lake Clark, hunting and fishing, little getaway for him, and has funded, sometimes controversially, some of the campaigns against it, including this initiative that's in the Lakes and Peninsula Borough coming up right now, the Save Our Salmon Initiative.
Can you clarify something for me and perhaps for a number of the viewers and listeners?
Maybe.
The question of Gillum owning a lodge, is a lodge usually implies that it's for commercial purposes.
His attorney wrote me a letter to that effect yesterday, actually.
I referred
him to Merriam-Webster, which says that, you know, a lodge is not necessarily a commercial endeavor. He did, when Alaska Magazine did a profile of him where he flew them out to his abode on the lake there, referred to it as a 14-bedroom lodge. So we use the word lodge in the story. His attorney didn't like it, you know. But no, it's not somewhere you can go rent a room.
As opposed to 14-bedroom home.
Exactly. Home was what his attorney would have preferred.
Okay. And yeah. There's going to be a vote down there
in the Lakes and Peninsula Borough on the Save Our Salmon Initiative, which would change the code to prohibit any development that would threaten salmon habitat, which would, of course, include and is aimed at Petaline. Even if it passes, like I said, they're not even to the permitting phase yet, so it could be overturned. All sorts of things could happen in the intervening years, no matter what.
They could vote to repeal it at some point.
It's not going to stop the exploratory process that's going on right now.
Well, beyond that, and I think since the story was written, too, they've introduced, should I just claim here, the company that I work for is owned by a company that has interest in mining or represents mining interest across the state, just so everybody knows
that. They're talking about they do public relations
work? They do public relations work for them, advertising for them, that kind of stuff. I personally do not. What has happened since I think that story was written in the last couple of weeks is there's been an interjection of religion into this thing.
Yes, there has.
There's been the Russian Orthodox Church priest has gotten into it. There was a nasty email out there about who's doing what to get support and why. And you wonder, and you're watching this, and you're thinking, well, if Jerry Privo got involved, how much more of a fracas would it be? It is a huge mess out there right now. And the smallest part of this is such a tiny election in this borough.
Yeah.
And the fight is over, I think. Who will control Alaska's mining interests? Who controls mining in Alaska? The state of Alaska or small individual boroughs? And I think that's where it's going. The state, I don't think there's any doubt in anyone's mind, despite this vote or despite the fight up to that vote or the permitting process, at the end of the day, who's going to wind up controlling mining in this state? And it's going to be the state.
Mm-hmm. Brendan, you have anything you want to add?
I know. I think that's about it.
Okay, let's go on. Andrea, welcome. It's nice to have you on the show for the first time. Anchorage policeman Anthony Rollins was convicted of rape earlier this year. Now there are civil cases proceeding. His victims have gone to court. And it's not unusual in itself to have civil cases coming out of criminal cases. But spell this out for us.
Well, he was convicted, if you remember, at the beginning of February of 18 criminal counts. This is five women that came forward, well, six women in the trial. He was convicted on charges of five of them. The sixth one he was acquitted of because the jury, you know, presumably thought there wasn't enough evidence. It was he said, she said. Now we have nine separate lawsuits, nine separate civil suits from nine separate women. There was some question whether these could possibly go into a class action, but I'm told by the attorney for five of those women that these happened over a period of at least 3 years for her clients, and there's no possibility of these becoming a class action. What they specifically want to know, aside from money, because everybody thinks that these women want money, they want to know how is this not going to happen again. They want answers from the municipality of Anchorage. They want answers from APD. Tell us what you've done to prevent this. Have you installed cameras? Have you made it mandatory for if a male officer brings a female arrested person to a substation, is there going to be another officer present? What are we going to do to make sure there isn't going to be another predator in cops' clothing? Right now, as far as I have seen from court documents, Anthony Rollins is not represented by an attorney.
We should clarify here. Who is being sued by the plaintiffs?
Anthony Rollins, the Municipality of Anchorage, and the Anchorage Police Department, all three. And the basis of the suits is no matter what Anthony Rollins did, the city has some responsibility for what happened. Whether they knew it was happening or not, whether they did enough to stop it or not, is going to be the question now for nine juries, because Anthony Rollins and the city have said, okay, let's bring this to juries, and that's going to happen in 2012.
And there is a possibility that there could be a settlement. There have been cases before. There was at least one I can remember of a woman who was in the custody of the detox facility and was raped, and eventually it took quite a long time, but there was a settlement.
And if you remember, during the criminal trial, one of the key pieces of information that the state wanted in open court was Anthony Rollins' personnel file. what they were investigating him for. We know investigations were going back as far as 2008. What those exactly entailed are unclear because the city was successful in the criminal trial of saying, no, this is confidential. We cannot let this go in open court. In civil trials, what happens is those kind of background documents, information, are much more accessible. So the presumption could be that unless the city wants everything aired out of what they knew and when and what they did or didn't do to stop this, they could settle.
And speaking of aired out and the coverage, I haven't looked at the documents, the suits. Are the names of the plaintiffs themselves, the victims, on the suits? I assume they would be.
Some are, and some are just initials.
Oh, is that right?
It is, and it depends on how comfortable these women are with public scrutiny. During the criminal trial, the defense attacked them. The defense attacked their backgrounds, and so a lot of these women, from everything that I've heard from attorneys, are a little bit reluctant, but they want to make sure this stops. I should mention that at least three of the nine women are asking for specific money damages. One's asking for $1 million. The other two are asking for $100,000 each. But the five...
That doesn't seem like very much, $100,000.
It's not very much, but the five women who are represented by a single attorney, who I should add, was some of them were referred to this attorney by Star Standing Together Against mm-hmm. Rape. They're not asking for specific damages. They're asking for specific answers, and they say the only way that they're going to get these answers is if they sue the city.
And briefly, what is the municipality and the police department saying in reply?
They're not saying much. They're saying this is the beginning of a legal process. They're not going to say much of anything, but the mayor does say that any budget surpluses, and he never uses the word surplus, but any extra money in the Anchorage budget, he's going to hold on to for possible liabilities down the road. And one of the biggest liabilities right now are, you know, who knows how many millions of dollars if the city loses these civil lawsuits, the taxpayers are going to have to pay.
Okay, thank you very much. Paul, we're going to keep you on the court beat. The road to Juneau is, once again, if there is a road, it's certainly under planning.
Or from Juneau.
To or from Juneau is not only is it very controversial, it's in court once again. Tell us about the latest court appearance, and this is in the Ninth Circuit, right?
No, everything in Alaska winds up in federal court, I think. Essentially, they wanted to build a road, extend this road, probably down to ferry service so that we could get Juneau connected to the roads in the United States of America.
It's less than 10 miles.
It's not very far. Yeah. You wind up at 1.5 miles or 20 miles, take your choice. And it's an incredibly expensive road. It's in 2006 they did the environmental impact statement. I think in 2009, and a judge at the behest of environmental groups said no, you didn't consider the you didn't weigh improved ferry service versus the benefits of the road. Therefore, the EIS is insufficient, and now they're back starting that now instead of appealing from the Ninth Circuit to the Supreme Court. The state has decided what we'll do is we'll just redo the EIS and start over from that.
And probably makes sense in the sense that the Supreme Court takes very few cases, and the question would be,
if you could get that case there, I think the state thinks that it wouldn't make it. It just doesn't, it's not sexy enough for them.
Or that it maybe the legal grounds might not be.
Well, the legal ground. Yet. Well, the legal grounds. I mean, if you have,
and then you can't do anything while that appeal goes.
Exactly,
ahead.
And you're stuck, and you've got two different courts already against you. And it's easier just to start over and do it, and do it the way the first judge wanted you to do it.
Okay, Andrea, that's a tradition or practice at Channel 11 to sit down with the mayor and get a chat with him, but he's out of town this week and was in Washington, D.C. What can you tell us about that, and what do you expect when he gets back?
Well, he's pushing, he says, Anchorage's agenda in Washington, D.C. Of course, we know that one of the biggest projects Anchorage has right now is the Port of Anchorage. We talked about, you know, all of the various problems they've had with construction. Well, guess what? The mayor has been successful in sticking in another $14 million, I guess, in federal money going to the Port of Anchorage construction. He says it's vital. It's just one of the things he's pushing. He's also pushing transportation. And I think for Anchorage and cities across the state, the big question is for leaders is what are we going to do in an era without earmarks? how are we going to still get these projects funded that we think are essential for our communities? And we saw Senator Lisa Murkowski, she's not doing earmarks per se, she's adding to like the military appropriations budget. She just added a big chunk of money for Alaska. So I think leaders, including Mayor Dan Sullivan, are trying to figure out how to still get that piece of the federal pie for their communities.
And they're members of both parties in both houses of Congress who are saying, doing the exact same thing, adding money to the agency budgets, because they will argue, well, we don't care what these super conservatives say, these are vital projects for our areas, mm-hmm. right?
And it could be argued, too, that one of the roles of Congress is to get money and get federal resources for their regions, for their states. And, you know, our Alaska congressional delegation has been traditionally very successful in doing that. And it's going to be interesting going forward. Now we have the super committee of, delegates in Washington, D.C. that are trying
Members
to come
of
up.
Congress.
Exactly. And that are trying to come up with a debt deal solution and make cuts. And how are we still going to get that piece of the pie?
Okay, Brendan, news from Homer. The Homer News has been sued for libel and sued by an entity called the Bush Blade. Tell us about this unusual libel suit.
Yeah, actually, it's sued by a proprietress or former proprietress of the Bush Blade.
I didn't know there was such a word.
The Bush Blade?
No, the proprietress. I haven't heard that before, but anyway, go ahead.
I think it's a word. the Bush Blade, We found that Scott Christensen wrote this story, and we've tried to find a copy of the Bush Blade and been unsuccessful in doing so. It was we have found a description of it as a monthly publication that focuses on ecological investigative reporting out of Kachemak Bay, out of the Homer area. And basically what this story is back in 2003, there was a rash of thefts of aviation headsets, which are worth between $600 and $1,200, depending on the headset and depending on who you ask.
These were stolen out of the aircraft?
Apparently, yes. In 2009, two brothers who are sons of the woman Ingrid Peterson from the Bush Blade, who has the libel lawsuit, two of her sons, Leif and Lars Peterson, were charged with theft by receiving because they were selling these aviation headsets on eBay. They weren't charged with going to the aircraft and taking them, but theft by receiving. They ended up settling it and paying restitution out of court. There were no convictions. Basically, the Homer News, a reporter named Michael Armstrong, reported on this, referred to the Bush Blade because that was the eBay username that it was being sold under. He didn't realize, apparently, that there was a publication called the Bush Blade either. But because he put this the name of the Bush Blade as the username, and then the two brothers who pled out or cut the deal for restitution into his story and named them, their mother, Ingrid Peterson, is suing the Homer News for libel. Since then, John McKay, a local attorney who represents all of us media outlets, I believe, has gotten the lawsuit dropped down to Shirley being against the chairman of Morris Communications, which owns the Homer News and published it, Will Morris, down in Augusta, Georgia. And it doesn't seem like it's going to go very far. But interesting small-town media story.
It is interesting, and I guess that what was the libel?
The libel was... And this is where
or the alleged libel.
Ms. Peterson says that in the story, Mr. Armstrong wrote, "When they stole" is the phrase that appeared in the story, referring to her sons. The actual charge was theft by receiving, so it wasn't really when they stole. Now the sort of barometer for libel is malice. So whether or not whether or not the reporter Mr. Armstrong knew that and maliciously said that when they stole rather than when they theft by received, it's going to be awfully hard to prove in a court of law. And this has actually gone to, it's in U.S. District Court now. It's been removed from the state courts and gone on to
and that's where it probably court. Should be. Okay, Paul, you're still on the court beat. According to federal prosecutors, Fairbanks and Schaefer Cox came to the FBI's attention a couple years ago or a while back when he bragged to a Montana group that He had pretty much an army underway and a government in waiting as an alternative. When the day came to do what needed to be done to change the United States by violent means, tell us more.
I think he may have stopped short of advocating overthrow by violent means. The FBI.
Let's just say when the
took
day
what
came.
what he said as to be that. This is one of those complicated, weird stories where a guy goes around and he's talking.
He's very young.
Giving speeches. He's got a shadow government. We've got a judiciary, he says. We've got police. We've got to have you arrested. We've got a shadow court. We can do all these things, and we're not afraid of anybody. And we've got these weapons, and we've got hand grenades, and we've got all these high-tech things the judges have found they didn't have. They had automatic weapons and hand grenades, which are high-tech enough for me, I suppose. But you run into these things, and what they're trying to find out now is where his free speech rights abridge, because you know, you and I could stand up and say pretty much anything, and have over the years, but until you advocate overthrowing the government, we're probably okay, at least by violent means. They won't tell him what it was and what he said that triggered the investigation that wound up with all the high-tech weapons and the shadow government. We don't know how the FBI got from point A to point F, I guess is where it is at this point. And that's what they're trying to do.
Presumably that's what the trial would do.
That's what
on the other hand,
do.
The defense is going to argue the classic whiskey talk defense.
He was drunk. He was a kid, you know.
Well, they're going to argue that too.
Sure.
Right.
Sure. These guys came about as close as you can come to doing things that would get you in a lot of trouble. I think the FBI probably has the obligation to kind of keep track of these people, but I think that if somebody says, well, what was the First Amendment basis for your starting a criminal investigation, I think they should be pretty forthcoming.
And there's
that.
Always the question of conspiracy law and proving a conspiracy or charging with a conspiracy. Okay, thank you very much, Paul. Andrea, KTVA had a story recently on food stamps, the number of Alaskans who are on food stamps. Many of us see people using the stamps or vouchers in the store, but this was quite surprising to me.
It was surprising in the number of Alaskans. Over 92,000 Alaskans are on food stamps. And if you break that down, it's about 1 in 7 of our friends, coworkers, family members. That's a huge number. According to the state, it's on the rise. It's also interesting that people can only use food stamps for 2 weeks. Okay, 2 weeks. That's about, $19 a week that they can get in food. What happens after that? Well, they're going to the Food Bank of Alaska. They're going to different food pantries around town, and those are running out of donations. And so, okay, that runs out. You can no longer go. Maybe you can go once a month to every food pantry or to a single food pantry. Then they're at Beans Cafe. And this is really, I mean, these are people that the state qualifies as the working poor. These are people who have steady jobs. They just can't quite make ends meet. And then another startling statistic that has come out is that the number of Alaskans who are food insecure, and that's a term that I didn't know until a few days ago, food insecure is also on the rise. That means the number of Alaskans who don't know where their next meal is coming from and the number of Alaskans who don't have access to healthier meals is also on the rise. And this is, you know, National Hunger Action Month. And, you know, there's various food drives going on around town. And something interesting to note, every dollar of donation donated to the Food Bank of Alaska gets about 5 pounds of food. So,
and this is very consistent with national stories we've seen about declining income among Americans of all age groups, declining purchasing power of Americans of all age groups. It's really quite surprising and quite disturbing, and I guess it shouldn't be surprising that it's affecting Alaska.
Well, you know, we've been pretty insulated from a lot of the economic downturn in the rest of the nation, but, you know, it's still trickling down, and to see so many Alaskans, 92,000, some estimates say 95,000 Alaskans really can't make ends meet enough to be able to eat their next meal. That's surprising. And, you know, a big question for lawmakers, Alaskan lawmakers, this next session is, what are we going to do for kids? There was a Senator Wilikowski bill that was introduced last session that failed, that just basically got stalled, that said, hey, let's increase the amount of money we give to schools for school lunch programs. You know, the support isn't there.
At the moment, anyway.
Exactly.
Brendan, the Talkeetna Blues Festival is singing the blues. No more festival.
Bluegrass.
No more bluegrass festival.
Yes.
No more bluegrass.
Yes.
It's over. What happened? And the curtain went down for the last time.
Yes. The Talkeetna Bluegrass Festival for Alaskans of a couple generations, I believe, has been sort of an institution. It's a big crazy party out in the woods ever since 1981. A guy named Dirty Ernie Wheatley has been in charge of it. At some point, I think 18 years ago, he bought his own spread out near Talkeetna, in mile 102, I believe it is, and ran this big party, thousands of people. At some point, it became maybe not so much about the bluegrass as it was about the party. But and everybody who's a teenager and spent some time out there has their own stories about it. And anyway, it came to an end after problems with the borough and the organizers were getting old.
How about that? We won't comment on old, but we will tell you we're coming to an end. Thank you very much for joining us. We'll see you next week right here.
If you have questions or comments about the program, you can email Alaska Edition at alaskaedition@alaskapublic.org or write us at 3877 University Drive, Anchorage, Alaska, 99508. Alaska Edition is a production of KAKM. The opinions expressed are those of the host and guests, and do not necessarily represent those of KSKA, KAKM, the licensee, or their underwriters.